headlines, a funeral is held in Baghdad for those killed in U.S. air raids against Iraqi resistance forces inside of Iraq and in Syria. Iran censures the U.N. for refusing to blacklist Israel and the Saudi-led coalition over their crimes against Palestinian and Yemeni children. Some 10 million Australians go under a lockdown amid an outbreak of the highly contagious Delta variant of COVID-19. Thanks for joining us. Iraqis have held a funeral for the resistance forces killed in U.S. airstrikes on Monday. The funeral was held in the capital, Baghdad. The Iraqi resistance forces were killed in the U.S. air raids that hit their positions inside of Iraq and Syria. The Iraqi government slammed the strikes and pledged to study all legal options to prevent such raids in the future. The Iraqi military also wrapped the raids as a breach of the country's sovereignty. The popular mobilization units promised to down any hostile U.S. airplanes flying over Iraq. The PMU says four of its members were killed in the U.S. airstrikes. The attacks come amid growing calls in Iraq for the withdrawal of U.S.-led foreign forces from the country.
The Pentagon confirmed it carried out airstrikes in positions of Iraq's popular mobilization units on both sides of the country's border with Syria. The Pentagon claimed the Sunday night strikes were defensive and in retaliation for what it called the PMU's drone attacks on U.S. personnel and facilities in Iraq. But the PMU forces roundly rejected any involvement. They said they are part of Iraq's regular armed forces and that the soldiers who died in the U.S. raids were guarding the border. The PMU forces warned that they are ready to take revenge. The U.S. airstrikes are the second of their kind to be ordered by President Joe Biden against the PMU since he took office in January. Biden says the strikes are meant to end what he calls for forces attacks on U.S. interests, but Iraqis see things differently.
The Iraqi people, government officials, factions and political figures see this attack as a boon to Daesh and other terrorists in Iraq and Syria. Through this attack, the U.S. seeks to weaken PMU forces in Iraqi and Syrian border areas so that Daesh terrorists can enter the Iraqi territory and carry out terrorist attacks. Effectively, the U.S. is now standing united with Daesh against the people of Iraq and its interests.
The strikes have been condemned across the political spectrum in Iraq. Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi denounced the airstrikes as a blatant and unacceptable violation of Iraq's sovereignty and its national security. The Iraqi military also issued a rare statement saying the U.S. move was a breach of the country's sovereignty. Different factions in the Iraqi parliament also condemned the airstrikes and called for steps to ensure such attacks will not repeat. They say the solution is ending the U.S. military presence in Iraq. That would be in line with a resolution adopted by the Iraqi parliament in January 2020, which called on the government to end the presence of all foreign troops in the country. The Iraqi parliament passed a resolution days after the U.S. assassinated Iran's top general Qasem Soleimani, along with a deputy commander of the PMU forces, Abu Mehdi al-Mohandes, in an airstrike near Baghdad airport. The U.S. has carried out more airstrikes on PMU positions ever since. During the period, Daesh terrorists have been the only other perpetrator of attacks on the popular forces.
Israeli forces have demolished a store belonging to a Palestinian family in occupied East Jerusalem al-Quds. The facility was located in the Silwan neighborhood. Palestinians clashed with Israeli forces while the building was being demolished. The Palestinian Red Crescent says four were injured as a result. The demolition is the latest in Israel's long-running campaign of destroying Palestinian structures in occupied territories. Israel usually claims the structures lack construction permits, but Palestinians say that the demolitions are in line with Israel's land grab policy, as the regime expands the settlements on occupied land. Israeli settlements are illegal under international law. Palestinian farmers and traders in the Gaza Strip have held a rally to voice their anger at Israel over its inhumane restrictions put on exporting goods and crops. The demonstrators say the restrictions have led to dire economic crisis in the impoverished enclave. Ruba Shabit has more from Gaza.
Farmers, traders, and exporters of agricultural crops held a demonstration in front of the United Nations headquarters in Gaza to deliver the representative of the United Nations a protest letter against new restrictions imposed by Israel to export Palestinian agricultural crops like vegetables. Israeli closure of borders has led to a huge damage in the agricultural sector of the Gaza Strip.
We have come here to protest against Israeli closure of borders. We want to sell our products in the West Bank and other parts of the world. Israel intends to ruin our lives by adopting such restrictive measures. We call on all human rights organizations to do something.
Palestinian farmers are facing serious financial losses due to the Israeli closure of borders. This is viewed in Gaza as part of a larger plan by Israel to destroy Palestinian economy. Palestinian farmers called on the international community to be committed to its responsibilities and pressurize Israel into opening the borders.
Israel's new restrictive measures will ruin our crops before they reach the target markets. All of our vegetables are stuck here and eventually destroyed. I'm standing here to protest these restrictions that have made our lives unbearable. We demand opening of the borders so we can export our products. This blockade is inhumane.
Along with the Israeli ban on export, the latest aggression on the Gaza Strip has doupled the damage in the agricultural sector. This has led to severe losses in this sector as Palestinian farmers can barely afford the living.
Our message to the United Nations is that Israel's measures are aimed to deteriorate life of all Palestinian farmers and traders. The latest Israeli aggression has inflicted a heavy blow on the agricultural sector. Israeli restrictions have no purpose but to ruin the agricultural sector of Gaza.
Due to the Israeli ban on the exportation of goods, the prices for agricultural products in Gaza have dropped significantly. Palestinian farmers and traders here say that the Israeli restrictions imposed on exporting crops aim to destroy the Palestinian economy. They call on the international community to end these restrictions and open the borders. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Iran's ambassador to the UN has criticized the world body for excluding Israel and the Saudi-led coalition from its list of violators of children's rights. Majid Taftar Ramanchi said the most systematic and gross violation of the rights of children in West Asia continues by the Israeli regime. He cited UN data that showed over 1,000 cases of Israeli violations against 340 Palestinian children. Taftar Ramanchi also said that over 3,500 children have been killed in the Saudi-led war in Yemen, as stated by a UN report. The UN Secretary General added that Yemen's Ansarullah movement to the blacklist, citing an alleged use of child soldiers. Yemen has vehemently rejected the accusation. Political commentator Jafar Ramini says the UN was created as a tool for Western powers to make the rest of the world believe that they are upholders of democratic and human values.
That nobody should look for any justice or any humanity from the UN. The UN was created as a tool for Western powers to show that they are democratic and they have human values. Nothing of the sort. While you have America in there exercising the right of veto, nothing tangible or nothing human will happen. Israel is protected. They are the favorite child of the United States of America, and so is Saudi Arabia. And there is this sacred cow called the West's interest that should be protected at any cost. And if you look at the social media, there is every day at least a dozen pictures of Palestinian children of the age of 7, 8, and 9, and sometimes even 5, are dragged brutally by the Israeli occupation forces, put in prison, not allowed access by their parents or legal representation.
Iran has marked the 1981 bombing of the headquarters of the Iran Islamic Republic Party by the U.S.-backed Mujahideen-e-Khalq terror organization known as MKO. The occasion is marked every year as part of week-long ceremonies dubbed the American Human Rights Week, Yusuf Jalali reports.
Rights activists, along with families of terror victims in Iran, attended this gathering in Tehran to mark the American Human Rights Week. The annual occasion aims to shed light on the U.S.'s record of rights violations in Iran.
We're marking the American Human Rights Week to review the numerous cases where the U.S. openly violated human rights in our country, like the American Navy's downing of our passenger plane in 1988, after which the perpetrators received a badge of honor in the U.S. The latest crime the U.S. has committed was to assassinate the spearhead of the fight against terrorism, General Qasem Soleimani.
The second day of the week-long occasion marks the 1981 bombing of the headquarters of the Iran Islamic Republic Party in Tehran by the U.S.-backed Mujahideen-e-Khalq terror organization, known as the MKO. 73 leading officials of the Islamic Republic were killed, including former Justice Chief Ayatollah Muhammad Ali Beheshti.
Iran says it has lost over 17,000 people in terrorist attacks. 12,000 of them were killed at the hands of the formidable MKO terrorist group. What's even more shocking is that the U.S. does not regard the MKO as a terrorist entity and has even established intimate ties with them.
The U.S. and Europe delisted the MKO as a terrorist organization. Following this measure, the group was relocated from its former stronghold at a U.S. military base in Iraq to Albania and France. Ever since, the MKO has held regular meetings with American and European officials.
Members of U.S. Congress regularly meet MKO leaders where they offer any kind of support to the terrorist group. The U.S. is still supporting the terrorists in their anti-Iran campaigns. The MKO killed our top nuclear scientists, and that was not possible without the U.S. and Israel's assistance.
I lost my husband in the 1981 bombing of the Islamic Republic Central Office by the MKO. Interestingly, the spearhead of the terrorist operation, whose real name is Ali Mohtamed, took refuge in the Netherlands, and they welcomed him until a few years ago, when the MKO disposed of him as a lost cause.
The American Human Rights Week started on June 27th, which marks the anniversary of the failed assassination of the then-Iranian president Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei by the MKO terrorists in 1981, and will end on July the 3rd, which coincides with the anniversary of the U.S. Navy's shooting down of an Iranian passenger plane in 1988. Organizers of the occasion say the ultimate goal of the week-long ceremonies is to expose the U.S.'s double standards when it comes to the issue of human rights. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
India has reported 907 new coronavirus deaths and over 37,000 new infections in the 24 hours to Tuesday. Daily cases have been declining in India following their peak of over 400,000 in May. In terms of total infections, India is now the world's second worst hit country after the U.S. with over 30 million cases. The Asian country also has the world's third largest death toll with around 380,000 fatalities. Meanwhile, the Red Cross in Indonesia says that the country is on the verge of a COVID-19 catastrophe. The group says officials are already setting up tents outside of the capital, Jakarta, to house patients. That's amid low oxygen supplies. Indonesia has registered record number of daily infections over the past days. More major cities in Australia, meanwhile, have imposed COVID-19 lockdown measures to fight flare-ups of the highly contagious Delta variant. Brisbane, the capital of Queensland state, has become the fourth major city to issue stay-at-home orders. The three-day snap lockdown there begins Tuesday evening. Sydney, Perth, and Darwin have already issued similar orders. In total, 10 million Australians are now under lockdown. The country has been broadly successful in containing virus clusters, but now the authorities are saying that they have to be cautious and take what they call tough decisions due to the Delta variant. The strain was first identified in India. The UK Conservative government has been mocked by another scandal, this time involving its former Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, who resigned after he breached COVID protocols. His replacement, former Chancellor Sajid Javid, has promised to tackle both the country's lockdown uncertainty and bring the faltering health service under control. But his critics are asking if he is the right man for the job. Amina Taylor has more from London.
Britain has a new man in charge of the country's health service. Former Chancellor Sajid Javid replaces Matt Hancock to helm the most under-pressure department in government. First point of order, attempting to manage the COVID crisis.
I want to see the restrictions lifted and life going back to normal as quickly as possible. And that's at my right here and now, that is my absolute priority.
But this is no ordinary cabinet reshuffle. Previous Health Minister Matt Hancock was forced to step down after embarrassing revelations about his private conduct were made public.
I understand the enormous sacrifices that everybody in this country has made, that you have made, and those of us who make these rules have got to stick by them, and that's why I've got to resign.
Despite presiding over the shambolic handling of Britain's COVID response, it became clear that Hancock had fallen out of favour inside Downing Street.
I think it's really likely he was pushed. The exact provenance of the CCTV footage from within his office is not clear, but it's clear that it would be very hard to access that if you weren't in some way strongly connected to the government. So if Boris didn't want him to go, someone did very much, quite clear that his position was no longer tenable.
For those hoping there'd be a change in approach from the new health chief, they may well be disappointed.
There is no ideological difference between Sajid Javid and Matt Hancock. It's a new face, just as Jeremy Hunt. Jeremy Hunt became an absolutely figure of hate while he was presiding over the NHS, precisely because he was implementing these ongoing privatisation policies. We're living with the consequences of the NHS being driven into the ground. We've seen unprecedented, really, corruption, giving away, gifting tens and hundreds of billions during this pandemic. Sajid Javid, I have no doubt, will continue in the same line.
Britain's National Health Service was already creaking at the seams even before the pandemic. And for the millions who've been waiting to see a medical professional, well, they won't mind who is in charge of the health service. They just want to be made better, and made better soon. With COVID dominating the health agenda, Sajid Javid will have his work cut out for him. And as the fate of his two predecessors has shown, landing the top job is the easy part. Mina Taylor, London.
And that is for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به وقت حالا.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, we are going to continue discussing Imam Khomeini's testament, where he explains the two weighty things, namely the Noble Quran and the Ahlul Bayt, or the infallible progeny of the Prophet of Islam. Imam Khomeini explains the great achievements of the Islamic Revolution and warns against the threats ahead of this revolution and the oppressed nations. Stay with us, please. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, believed that the traditional jurisprudence is the explicator of the school of the Prophet and his infallible successors, and calls on the Iranian nation to stick to this school firmly. He writes in his testament, "I ask Muslim nations seriously and urgently to follow the infallible Imams and the political, social, economic, and military culture of these great guides of mankind properly and wholeheartedly through sacrificing their souls and dear ones, so that they do not become deviated from the traditional jurisprudence, which is the school of prophethood and imamat, and guarantees the growth and grandeur of nations, and do not listen to the temptation of adversary enticers and enemies of truth and religion. And they should know that a single deviated step will be the prelude for collapse of religion, Islamic laws, and the divine rule of justice." Imam Khomeini attached high importance to congregational prayers, especially Friday prayers, and morning ceremonies of the infallible Imams, particularly Imam Hussein, peace upon him. He writes, "Never neglect Friday prayer and congregational prayer, which indicate the political aspect of prayer. This Friday prayer is among the greatest graces of Almighty God to the Islamic Republic of Iran. And people should never neglect the morning ceremonies of the infallible Imams, especially the Lord of the Oppressed and Master of Martyrs, Abu Abdullah al-Hussein, peace upon him. And they should know that it is the order of the Imams, peace upon them, to rever this historical epic of Islam, and whatever curse is uttered against the oppressors of Ahlul Bayt are all heroic cries of nations against the oppressive leaders throughout history. And it is necessary to loudly and effectively remind in the elegies and panegyrics of the rightful Imams, the catastrophes and oppressions of every era and place." Imam Khomeini emphasizes that his testament is not limited to the Iranian nation, and that he has in fact addressed the entire Islamic world and the whole oppressed and downtrodden in the world. He writes, "We know that the Islamic Revolution, which cut the hand of the world devourers and oppressors from Iran, has triumphed with the unseen divine assistance. Had there not been the able hand of the one God, it would have been impossible for the 36 million population to triumph against such an anti-Islamic and anti-clergy propaganda, particularly during the recent 100 years, and such excessive seditious acts of the writers and media and speeches and anti-Islamic and anti-national circles, and so many centers of debauchery, gambling, drinks, and narcotics in order to draw the young generation to corruption and indifference, and efforts to seclude and isolate the clergy and also divert many of them. It was impossible for this nation to rise up unanimously in such condition with a unified idea and the shouts of Allahu Akbar across the country to dismantle the internal and external powers with astonishing and miraculous sacrifices to hold the authority of the country. Thus, there is no doubt that the Islamic Revolution of Iran is different from all revolutions, both in the emergence and quality of a struggle and also the motive of revolution and uprising. No doubt, this divine present and unseen gift has been granted by the all-merciful God to this oppressed and looted nation. Imam Khomeini continues in his testament, "Islam and the Islamic government is a divine phenomenon which, if it is put into practice, will secure in the best way the prosperity of our children in this world and the hereafter, and is able to efface oppressions, lootings, corruptions, and aggressions with red pen, blood, and take humans to their desirable ideal. Islam is the school which, unlike non-monotheistic schools, plays a role and interferes in and supervises all individual, social, material, spiritual, cultural, political, military, and economic efforts, and does not neglect even the most trivial points in the education of human being and the society and the material and spiritual progress. Now that, with the help and grace of God, the Islamic Republic has been established by the able hand of the devoted nation, it is necessary for the nation to try to materialize and safeguard its whole contents as the preservation of Islam on top of all obligations. Today, it is an obligation, especially for the Iranian nation and the entire Muslims in general, to preserve this divine trust with all their effort and try to create the requirements of its survival and remove the barriers and problems." Imam Khomeini points to the element of safeguarding the victory, saying, "Undoubtedly, the element of survival of the Islamic Revolution is the very element of victory, and the nation knows the element of victory. And the future generations will read in history that its two pillars have been the divine motive and the lofty purpose of Islamic rule, and that the convergence of the nation all over the country with one motto has been for this very motive and purpose. I recommend to all present and future generations that if they want Islam and the rule of God to survive powerfully and cut the hand of the internal and external colonialists and exploiters from your country, you should not lose this divine motive that Almighty God has recommended in the Noble Quran, and you should know that opposite of this motive, which is the element of victory and its survival, is forgetting the goal and discord and difference. It is not accidental that the propaganda horns across the world have focused all their efforts on rumors and seditious lies and spent billions of dollars on it. And the constant trips of the opponents of the Islamic Republic to the region are not without motive."
the debate.
Once again, targets in Iraq has been hit in its border with Syria. Iraq has condemned the U.S. airstrikes as a violation of its sovereignty and national security. Why would the U.S. target the legitimate forces of Iraq that it calls illegitimate, accusing them of targeting U.S. forces? This is the second time that the U.S. under Joe Biden has made the decision to strike Iraq. Will this risk a war between U.S. forces and the PMU forces? Stay tuned to the debate.
The Pentagon confirmed it carried out airstrikes in positions of Iraq's popular mobilization units on both sides of the country's border with Syria. The Pentagon claimed the Sunday night strikes were defensive and in retaliation for what it called the PMU's drone attacks on U.S. personnel and facilities in Iraq. But the PMU forces roundly rejected any involvement. They said they are part of Iraq's regular armed forces and that the soldiers who died in the U.S. raids were guarding the border. The PMU forces warned that they are ready to take revenge. The U.S. airstrikes are the second of their kind to be ordered by President Joe Biden against the PMU since he took office in January. Biden says the strikes are meant to end what he calls for forces attacks on U.S. interests, but Iraqis see things differently.
The Iraqi people, government, officials, factions, and political figures see this attack as a boon to Daesh and other terrorists in Iraq and Syria. Through this attack, the U.S. seeks to weaken PMU forces in Iraqi and Syrian border areas so that Daesh terrorists can enter the Iraqi territory and carry out terrorist attacks. Effectively, the U.S. is now standing united with Daesh against the people of Iraq and its interests.
The strikes have been condemned across the political spectrum in Iraq. Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi denounced the airstrikes as a blatant and unacceptable violation of Iraq's sovereignty and its national security. The Iraqi military also issued a rare statement saying the U.S. move was a breach of the country's sovereignty. Different factions in the Iraqi parliament also condemned the airstrikes and called for steps to ensure such attacks will not repeat. They say the solution is ending the U.S. military presence in Iraq. That would be in line with a resolution adopted by the Iraqi parliament in January 2020, which called on the government to end the presence of all foreign troops in the country. The Iraqi parliament passed a resolution days after the U.S. assassinated Iran's top general Qasem Soleimani, along with a deputy commander of the PMU forces, Abu Mehdi al-Muhandis, in an airstrike near Baghdad Airport. The U.S. has carried out more airstrikes on PMU positions ever since. During the period, Daesh terrorists have been the only other perpetrator of attacks on the popular forces.
Our guest joining us for this edition of the debate, Senior Research Fellow at the Global Policy Institute, George Samieli, joins us from Budapest. And we also have writer and political analyst John White joining us from Edinburgh. I'd like to welcome you both. And John White, let me first go to you and ask you about the U.S. version of what has happened, in which it said the U.S. military targeted operational and weapons storage facilities at two locations in Syria and one in Iraq in response to drone attacks by what the U.S. calls militia against U.S. personnel and facilities in Iraq.
Well, the U.S. presence of the countries is entirely in violation of international law. They are not there at the invitation of the legally constituted governments of both countries. Indeed, on the contrary, they're there at the with the opposition of both governments. So they are an occupying force, and therefore their presence in both countries is illegal. Now, it seems clear to me that the Biden administration constitutes no step change from the previous Trump administration or the previous Obama administration. It's a case of the new boss, same as the old boss. The only difference is one of approach. So this was a vile act of international brigandage and piracy against popular mobilization units in Iraq who have been the only thing standing between Iraq's sovereignty and status as a secular state and the black flag of ISIS or Salafi jihadism flying over Baghdad. It's a disgrace. It's not in keeping with the trajectory of the region, which is towards an axis of resistance against U.S. imperialism and all its conceits.
Well, Joe Samieli, the U.S. Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, has said there are airstrikes against what he calls Iran-backed militias. in Iraq and Syria over the weekend were a necessary, and I'm quoting him, and appropriate action meant to limit the risk of escalation. How does that limit the risk of escalation?
Well, of course, it doesn't limit the risk of escalation in any way whatsoever. It's very amusing that the United States keeps repeating this mantra of, well, this is a proportionate response against Iran-backed militia, and that the United States is present in Iraq legally, and the only reason why it's in Iraq is that it is fighting ISIS. Now, of course, as my colleague has just pointed out, and the forces that are fighting ISIS the most effectively have been the forces that the United States has just struck, these so-called Iran-backed militia. And of course, the forces that have been fighting ISIS the least effectively have been the forces by the United States. Now, of course, the United States is not present in Iraq legally. I mean, that's the point. I mean, the Pentagon statement and the statement of Anthony Blinken is completely false. The United States has no legal justification for being in Iraq. It was in January 2020, following the assassination of General Soleimani, that the Iraqi parliament demanded that the United States leave Iraq. The United States has not done so, has no intention of doing so. So it's, you know, the claim that somehow the United States is acting legally is completely false. And the rationale behind the strike, we're fighting the Iran-backed militia, is itself bogus, because these are the forces that are actually fighting ISIS the most effectively.
Okay, so if you don't mind, John White, holding on to that thought that the U.S. is not in Iraq legally, this is what the Prime Minister, Mustafa al-Karimi, has said along with the Iraqi army. We condemn, quote, the U.S. airstrike that targeted a site last night on the Iraqi-Syrian border, which represents a blatant and unacceptable violation of Iraqi sovereignty and Iraqi national security, according to all international conventions. Now, this is not the first time that this has happened, John White, and if the U.S. is in Iraq illegally, I'm wondering what the Iraqi officials actually are saying to the U.S., to the respective parties there in the U.S., like what the Prime Minister says, don't do it again, which the U.S. has done. I mean, what does Iraq say to the U.S., and what can the U.S. say in return?
Well, George Amul is absolutely correct. A vote was taken in the Iraqi parliament in 2020 to expel all U.S. officials, and the fact that they're still there, this proves beyond peradventure that this is not a democracy acting in the interest of democracy, it's an empire acting in the interest of empire. Obviously, the Iraqis don't have the power of the U.S., but there does have to come a stage where the U.N. intervenes to condemn resolutely and unreservedly U.S. machinations in Iraq and in Syria. This is not about any administration. Everybody was blinded by Joe Biden's folksy approach to politics, and he was going to be a step change from Donald Trump. No. As I said earlier, this is just a difference in approach. The objective is the same, which is to maintain U.S. fading hegemony in the Middle East and on a wider level across the world. So the tectonic plates of geopolitical and geostrategic power are shifting from the West to the East, and thus we are in a period of interregnum. And it's a very dangerous period, because no empire leaves the stage of history without a hard-fought struggle. And this issue and this incident is part of that struggle. The Iraqi people, the Syrian people, are victims of this U.S. empire, but I have confidence that before long, this U.S. empire will cease to be a realistically strong force in the region. The people of the region have rejected them. It's only a matter of time before they understand that they have no longer any purchase in that region or anywhere else in the global south.
We have talked about or touched on the fact, George Samueli, that Iraq has been able to defeat the Daesh terrorists. It was successful in doing that. And one of the reasons that it was able to do that was because of the PMU forces, the same forces that the U.S. keeps saying these are Iran-backed militias, of which it basically says they're illegitimate. And an observation here that I'd like to get your reaction on this, George Samueli, is that this attack took place the day after there was a major military parade which featured these PMU forces. And that was a grand parade, and it was really a show of force. Do you think that the timing of this has anything to do with that in terms of the U.S. choosing the day after this military parade took place?
Well, it's quite possible. I don't know that for a fact. But there's no question that the United States is desperate to ensure that any of the indigenous forces basically are unable to perform effectively. I mean, let's remember, there would have been no ISIS had there been no U.S. intervention in Iraq. And we know that from 2014 on, the Obama administration was looking on benignly as ISIS grew in power in Iraq and in Syria. We know this is a record of this, that we know that they were looking for ISIS to effect regime change in Iraq and regime change in Syria. And, you know, the United States only took the fight against ISIS seriously, if we can say, if we can even use the term seriously in this context, after President Putin announced in September 2015 that Russia was going to step in and take care of business with ISIS. And suddenly the Obama administration said, oh, yeah, yeah, we're in on this as well. But up until then, the United States was very, very happy to see the rise of ISIS, just as today the United States is the biggest protector of al-Qaeda in the Middle East, because it knows perfectly well that the biggest center of al-Qaeda forces is in Syria, in Idlib, and it continues to resist any attempt by the Syrian government and Russia to bring this al-Qaeda enclave to an end.
Okay, it was in December of this past year, John White, when the U.S. Actually made an announcement that it's going to withdraw its forces from Iraq. It never followed through on that, per se. Of course, we could always say that the U.S. never really pulls out any of its forces completely, like in the case of Afghanistan. Nevertheless, do you think that there's a possibility that the U.S., knowing that the Iraqi parliamentarians, many of them want the U.S. out, many officials want the U.S. out of Iraq, but the U.S. wants to stay there because of Syria, in order for there to be some geographic advantage in that sense. Is that a reason why you think the U.S. is steadfast in staying in Syria, in Iraq?
Absolutely. The U.S. has done its best to undermine the Syrian government throughout its long conflict with ISIS and other Salafi jihadi forces. If not for U.S. machination in Syria, Salafi jihadism would have been smashed long before now. The U.S. is also under pressure from its regional allies, Israel and Saudi Arabia, to maintain a presence in order to bolster their machinations in the region. And these are two sectarian states that have no interest in seeing Syria being stabilized, no interest in seeing Iraq being stabilized, because for them the behemoth in the region is Iran. And the only reason that these countries despise Iran, the only reason these countries have set their face against Iran, is nothing to do with Iran's domestic or internal issues or the nature of its state. Every country has its own domestic challenges. It's because Iran does not bow. That's the only reason. Iran is a target, and the road to Tehran for the U.S. and its regional allies leads through Damascus and Iraq.
Okay. George Samioli, in the bigger picture, the U.S. president, during his campaign pledges and even when he came into office, on different occasions has said, we're winding down the wars, in reference to, of course, Afghanistan first, and then looking at what is happening in particular in Iraq and then Syria, saying that, you know, they want to reduce not only their presence, but as recently as just weeks ago, it confirmed that it's reducing by 8 the number of Patriot anti-missile batteries in the Middle East, which consisted of hundreds of troops, aircraft that they are removing or have removed. And this would be from Iraq, from Jordan, from Kuwait, and from Saudi Arabia. And, of course, their thing is with China, that it's a national security threat. They're going to focus on China and Russia. So then this, you know, strike comes, this is the second time now. It doesn't really look like they're going to disengage from this region, does it?
No, it really doesn't. And I think the key there is the role of Iran. Now, if you look at Iran, I mean, Iran has obviously been subject to consistent U.S. aggression since the Iranian Revolution. Iran has been subject to Israeli aggression for decades. And how does Iran resist? Well, obviously, Iran resists via its ballistic missile program, but it also resists via its proxy forces. And yeah, of course, it does have these proxy forces throughout the Middle East that it will initiate should there be a conflict between Iran and the United States or Iran and Israel. So these proxy forces, whether in Syria, whether it's in Iraq, whether it's in Lebanon, are absolutely vital to Iran's strategic interests. And of course, that's why Israel has been consistently targeting these forces and why the United States is anxious to target them, because they know that in any conflict with Iran, these, whatever you call them, these proxy, Iran proxy forces will be a very important part of Iranian resistance.
Trying to figure out the role of Israel in this, John, if you can help me out. You know, we have noticed how Israel has time and again attacked Syria on a number of occasions. And quite interestingly, there's been a lull in that situation. But since we've talked about Iran and since the U.S. keeps referring to the PMU forces as being malicious backed or aligned by Iran, we're under the impression, however, that there's these nuclear negotiations that the Biden administration is saying they're focused on. And because of that, Pentagon has actually said that they see this window where they're once that comes about, and if there is an agreement, that they're going to refocus or put their focus onto that alleged China threat. How do you see it?
Well, they're really doing their best to undermine the JCPOA, and they're doing their best under the new Prime Minister Naftali Bennett to undermine these talks in Vienna. This is one of the most weird coalitions of any Democrat or so-called Democratic government we've ever seen. They cannot stand the fact that Iran may return to being a power that can put its oil on the world markets and can have sanctions lifted, because for the Israelis, Iran is a menace that they cannot get rid of in their minds, because they understand that they are so vulnerable. Israel is a giant with feet of clay in the region. They're very vulnerable, and they see Iran as a country that will ultimately speed the way towards full Palestinian freedom, self-determination, and and the end of the Zionist project. That is what they fear most. Every Israeli government, regardless of who leads it, sees Iran as a direct threat to its expansionism, to its system of apartheid and ethnic cleansing and subjugation of the Palestinian people. So the Israelis are doing their best to lobby behind closed doors to the Biden administration, because the Biden administration has articulated that it wants to have wants to refocus on a two-state solution, even though that's dead in the water. So Iran is the solution to the freedom of the Palestinian people. The Israelis understand that, and that's why they fear Iran so much, and that's why they get so hysterical when it comes to anything involving Iran.
Okay. George Samueli, so now we have this strike, the second one that has taken place. The group that's within the PMU forces, as it was reported, they have vowed revenge. They have vowed to take down any U.S. airplane that actually flies over Iraq. If something like that happens, and I know it's talking about something that hasn't happened yet, but hypothetically, do you think that this is going to mean war?
Well, I mean, there's war already ongoing. Yes. If there is indeed a retaliation against U.S. forces, then the United States will escalate. I mean, it will escalate with attacks against Iraq. It will escalate with further attacks in Syria. I mean, what it's doing in Syria is is already just, I mean, that it's kind of almost, so it's beyond any kind of description as humanity. I mean, the horrific sanctions and everything. But in the case of Syria, it has pretty much a blank check. No one, as far as American public opinion is concerned, no one complains about any U.S. actions in Syria. Iraq is a little bit different because, at least in the case of Iraq, the United States tries to make this pretense, however fraudulent, that it is in Iraq at the invitation of the Baghdad government, and it is ostensibly there in order to help it fight ISIS. Of course, it's absolutely bogus, but if there is an escalation of conflict in Iraq, then it's going to become ever more difficult to maintain this fiction. But, you know, the U.S. propaganda machine is so powerful that, you know, I wouldn't have believed that after what happened in January 2020, after the Iraqi parliament had asked the United States to leave, that the United States would just continue ignoring the wishes of the Iraqi parliament and still insist before the world, oh, we are here at the invitation of the Iraqi people, the very Iraqi people that have just asked you to leave. So the U.S. propaganda machine is quite relentless in spreading fraud and lies.
Okay, thank you so much. We're going to end it there. That's Senior Research Fellow at Global Policy Institute, George Tomielli. Thank you for your comments. Also, John White, thank you, from Edinburgh, writer and political analyst. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Vitak, my entire team in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye until next time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره، همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program's To My Brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. We're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام: أصدقاؤك ثلاثة وأعداؤك ثلاثة، فأصدقاؤك صديقك وصديق صديقك وعدو عدوك، وأعداؤك عدوك وعدو صديقك وصديق عدوك.
Imam Ali stated, "Your friends are three and your enemies are three. Your friends are your friend, your friend's friend, and your enemy's enemy. And your enemies are your enemy, your friend's enemy, and your enemy's friend." Welcome back, dear friends. It's wonderful to have you with us on the program. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we're discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali, the son of Abu Talib. One of the great lessons, dear friends, which we learn from the truly universal persona of Imam Ali, alayhi salam, is the fact that we should ask for permission from Allah when we do things, and that the halal and the haram, the things that are permissible and the things that are unlawful in the religion of Islam, all have a reason behind them. But perhaps we don't know what it is. So one time when the river Euphrates, known as the Furat, overflew, it flooded and the city of Kufa was exposed to this flood, the inhabitants of the city, from fear of drowning, took refuge with Imam Ali alayhi salam. They pleaded him and asked him to please raise his divine and holy hands in prayer. And so Imam Ali, he mounted the Holy Prophet's special horse, and while being accompanied by the people, he went towards the bank of the river Euphrates. There, he dismounted from his horse, he performed the wudu, the ablution, and he turned towards the Qibla and stood up for prayer. The people of Kufa, who were looking on, saw Imam Ali raise his blessed hands in supplication after having performed his prayers. Relying on the staff which he had in his hand, he struck the water on the surface and said, "Stop overflowing with the permission of the Lord." The water in the river subsided on Imam Ali's order, subhanallah, to the extent that some fish could be seen. And amid this, most of the fish, they hailed in a voice and in a language where all could hear that they were saying, "Hail to the leader of the believers," except some of the fish, which were silent and didn't say anything. These fish were eels and of two other kinds. The people were astonished by the hail of some of the fish and the silence of others, and